It is time now for the next installment of a massive archive show, specifically Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. And when I talk about the U.S. losing the Second World War, I am in no way speaking figuratively. This is not a metaphor. Von Clausewitz, the famous Prussian military theoretician, noted, and this is an oft-quoted phrase, that war is the continuation of politics by other means. You will also see that translated, war is the continuation of policy by other means. In the nuclear age, it was simply not possible to defeat another nation by sending major army groups crashing across an opponent's border, because that would lead to mutually assured destruction. So what we are looking at in this program is politics, or policy, as the continuation of war by other means. This is a massive archive show. I'm doing it in installments, and I think it will go a long way toward explaining not only the history of the second half of the 20th century, but it will in particular explain how the United States has gotten to its present sorry state of affairs. I'm going to begin by reviewing some of the highlights of this archive show to date. We began by taking a look at the assassination of President Kennedy, one of the main base points, I should say, of the program that I've been doing for lo these many years, some 13 years now. And specifically, we took a look at George Bush, obviously the current president of the United States and the former director of the CIA, and we took a look at his relationship with George de Morenschild, a former Nazi spy, a white Russian, an individual who went to work for the U.S. intelligence community in the post-World War II period, using his petroleum industry activities as a cover. And we took a look at de Morenschild also, by the way, was one of Lee Harvey Oswald's babysitters. And we took a look at George Bush's place in an intelligence-slash-petroleum industry milieu, which was front and center and deeply involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. It remains to be determined whether George Bush personally was involved in some way with the JFK assassination. His name crops up in connection with the investigation in a number of different ways, and it appears almost certain, in fact it is certain at this point, that as director of the CIA, he frustrated congressional attempts to look into the connections between the CIA and Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. As I've said so often, the CIA did not kill President Kennedy, but there were CIA elements involved, and that necessitated a cover-up by the CIA proper. We began looking at this explicitly fascist milieu involving intersections and a cooperation between the intelligence community, the national security establishment, the American far right, and the petroleum industry in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy. After having examined this in the first two programs and how it operated in connection with the Kennedy assassination, we began to look at the historical development of this particular milieu. Now, from an historical slash political standpoint, the John Kennedy assassination represented or was three very important things. First of all, it was the culmination of a constitutional struggle between the military and the executive branch. The military has never liked having a civilian commander-in-chief. We took a look at that in considerable detail in our Aryan Nation series, Radio Free America programs 10 through 13. And we also have looked at the John Kennedy assassination as the triumph of rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War, as opposed to the containment theory of fighting the Cold War. And also, the assassination of President Kennedy represented, or was marked, I should say perhaps, the ascension of fascism in America. This evening, by the way, one of the central things that we're going to be focusing on is the generation of rollback or liberation theory vis-a-vis fighting the Cold War or waging the Cold War. And we're going to take a look specifically at the role of the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit in generating that particular philosophy, and with the involvement of Gehlen and Gehlen-related elements in the U.S. national security establishment and political establishment, and how that led to the formation of rollback theory. One of the things that we began looking at in connection with the evolution of the milieu, this explicitly fascist milieu that we looked at in connection with John Kennedy's assassination, well, we began looking at the plans by the Third Reich to go underground during the course of the Second World War. The Nazis had determined early on that they were going to lose the Second World War, and they began making plans for resurgence, for post-war resurgence, and for the continuation of Nazism. One of the major things that we looked at in connection with the Nazis having gone underground, and one of the dominant operant considerations that we're looking at in this particular archive series, concerns the Third Reich's strategic use of anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest. Specifically, the German General Staff and the Nazi Party learned in the immediate post-World War I period that the fear of communism, both by their own industrialists and financiers and the population in general, and by the Western Allies, in this case the Allies of World War I, could be used to their own ends. Specifically, because of the German Revolution at the end of World War I, the Allies saw to it, and the Ebert government of the Weimar Republic saw to it, that the German General Staff and the German Army basically remained intact, and then they permitted it to proceed to quell the German Revolution. This provided for the survival of the German General Staff and the German military and the Nazi Party, which grew directly out of the German General Staff and the German military. Hitler, of course, was initially a Reichswehr intelligence agent, and the Nazi Party in its inception, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 10, was, at least in the beginning, a front for Reichswehr intelligence. The Nazis' understanding of how anti-communism, the fear of communism, could be used as a vehicle for conquest is something that developed in the pre-World War II period and was utilized by the Nazis in the Second World War. It is one of the central operant and theoretical concepts in the analysis being presented in Radio Free America number 37. The Third Reich was able to achieve some of its astounding early military successes because many of the industrialists and financiers, as well as the general staffs allied with them, were more afraid of socialist movements in their own country than a domination by foreign fascists. Specifically, the French army was surrendered by Maréchal Pétain, the World War I hero and Vichy collaborator, so that it could be preserved, quote, to fight against communism. We took a look at the Third Reich's plans to go underground, specifically how the SS and Gestapo would constitute the core of the post-World War II Nazi underground, and another major strategic concept that the Third Reich in planning to go underground was formulating was a plan, to hook up with sympathetic elements in other countries in order to preserve Nazism and to further their ends. Specifically, one of the major goals of the Third Reich in the World War II planning period for their post-World War II operations was to hook up with fascist sympathizers, both industrialists and financiers, and people farther down on the socioeconomic scale who were sympathetic to fascism. And specifically, we took a look at how they planned to hook up with American industrialists and financiers of fascist sympathies in particular. We took a look, for example, at in the book The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Rees, at how, among others, the American tycoon William Grace might very well serve as a vehicle for the continuation of Nazism in the United States. William Grace was a good friend of the aforementioned George de Morenshield. We also took a look at the targeting by the Third Reich of Harry Jung's American Vigilant Intelligence Federation, a fascist organization, an explicitly anti-Semitic organization that worked with the Hitler Goebbels anti-Comintern in the 1930s and early 40s. The anti-Comintern was an international consortium of fascist organizations which was put together as an umbrella organization by the Third Reich. Jung's organization, Harry Jung's American Vigilant Intelligence Federation, was a major element in the United States of the anti-Comintern, and the files of Jung's organization served as the seed, so to speak, the seed for the files of an organization called the American Security Council. That organization deeply involved with an organization called the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and that organization, as we have seen, which went on to become a key element of the World Anti-Communist League, was and is a major element of U.S. national security and covert operations, and national security considerations and covert operations. The Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and related elements, and the ABN is very close to the Galen organization. The ABN was one of the major elements that we looked at in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, by the way, if I'm going a little quickly here, or if this sounds a little glib, I apologize. Suffice it to say that Archives on Audio should be contacted to get the earlier installments of Radio Free America 37, because this is a massive program, and necessarily in recapping what we've looked at so far in many, many hours of broadcasting real time, I've got to present things rather quickly, and I can appreciate it. This seems a little sketchy or a little glib. Simply get a hold of the archives and peruse the information at length and in detail. Now, in the most recent installment of Radio Free America 37, the program that I did last week, we took a look at how German and American industrialists and financiers who were associated with the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that was instrumental in promoting fascism in Europe. We took a look at how people like Alan Dulles on the American side and people like Gero von Gebernitz on the German side, both of them working in an intelligence capacity for their respective governments, were negotiating during the course of the Second World War in order to form what they referred to as the Christian West concept. This basically was a plan on the part of the Third Reich and agreed to, a plan that was drawn up by elements of the Third Reich and agreed to by elements of Western intelligence, particularly Alan Dulles, head of the Bern, Switzerland OSS office, to shed Adolf Hitler and the more venal elements of Nazism, and to have the residua of the Third Reich and Germany in general hook up with the United States and Britain and France in an anti-communist, anti-Soviet coalition. The Christian West concept, again, was developed by elements of the Third Reich, agreed to by elements of our intelligence system associated with the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I took a look at, or that we looked at in the first two Radio Free America shows, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Parts 1 and 2, and that we looked at in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika Archive show, the Uncle Sam and Il Duce Archive show, as well as Radio Free America number 10, and a miscellaneous archive show entitled Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans. And I encourage listeners not familiar with those programs to get a hold of them. Many of them I broadcast every Memorial Day weekend here on KFJC for those who are listening live. And for those of you who hear the program on tape, please get a hold of those archive shows, and it will flesh out your understanding of these particular events that I'm discussing. I would recommend very strongly, I do recommend, a current book called The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, H-E-R-S-H. It goes into not only that transatlantic financial and industrial axis, but its very strong connections to U.S. intelligence and to the origins of the CIA and the formation of the Christian West concept is discussed in detail in The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch. For my money, one of the very best books on the U.S. intelligence community and its origins. Now, as we looked at, the Christian West concept, basically a Third Reich concept, served as the seed concept for NATO. What we saw with NATO was a union, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, what we saw with NATO was a union between the United States and Britain and France and other European nations with Germany in an anti-Soviet alliance. And as we've looked at in Radio Free America program number 2 and the various archive shows that I have done about the Galen organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that we brought into the United States at the end of World War II, at the core of NATO was not only the Galen organization itself, an explicitly Nazi intelligence outfit, but beyond that, we took a look on how, in Radio Free America number 2, at how Nazism was never really removed from Germany. This is not to say that any given German is a Nazi, but the institutions of the Third Reich were never removed from what used to be known as the Federal Republic of Germany. The Third Reich's military people, many of them, its intelligence people in particular, many of the industrialists and financiers, and also many of the political figures from the Third Reich went on to dominate the operations of post-war Germany, initially the Federal Republic of Germany, and some of these same elements are in ascendance in the now United Germany. I would also refer listeners to a miscellaneous archive show that I recorded last March called The Old Germany and the New Nazis, which not only recaps a portion of Radio Free America number 2, but updates that to current goings-on with a very important paper by researcher Martin Lee. So again, one of the central features that was one of the features central to the Third Reich's plans to go underground was the Christian West concept, a formal divorce from Hitler and the most venal elements of Nazism in order to hook up with the so-called Western democracies, the U.S., Britain, and France, in an anti-Soviet alliance which would help to preserve not only German economic and military power, but also the political power of the Nazi Party. And this Christian West concept, and I realize this will seem controversial to many people, but the Christian West concept is basically what NATO was. The Christian West concept became NATO. It was the founding concept for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And Gero von Gebernitz, a Third Reich intelligencer and a member of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, was instrumental in forming with Alan Dulles the Christian West concept, along with Prince Max von Hohenlohe, a representative of the SS and the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS intelligence service. Gero von Gebernitz was also deeply involved in prevailing on American General Edwin Siebert to take the Galen organization into the United States. Now again, the Reinhard Galen organization originally was known as Fremde Heere Ost, or Foreign Armies East, the FHO. It was the Third Reich's Eastern Front intelligence organization during World War II. It then jumped to the United States and became, in turn, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. It became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and it was also installed as the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German intelligence service, while continuing to function as the main intelligence organization on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe for the CIA and for NATO. And as we've seen in numerous archive shows, the first three Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America numbers 11, 14, 15, 22, and 36, the Galen organization paved the way for the incorporation into the U.S. intelligence system of thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans, many of them war criminals of the First Order. Now, in the concluding element of last week's program, we looked at an article from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 3 by writer and researcher Carl Oglesby, and Oglesby advanced the concept that the Galen organization basically served as an arm of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground. Unfortunately, the Odessa is not merely a creature of fiction. It has been dealt with in espionage fiction. It was and is, unfortunately, a political reality. And Oglesby advances the theory that I also advanced in Radio Free America program number 3 from in June of 1984, that the Galen organization basically served as a branch of the Odessa, operating not only in the United States but later in Germany, and beyond that, and most importantly, functioning at the very center of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which again grew out of the Christian West concept, a World War II Nazi concept, which provided for the survival of the Reich, minus some of the, at least ostensibly, minus some of the more venal elements of Nazism, and that survived Reich was to function in conjunction with, again, the Western allies, U.S., Britain, France, etc., in an anti-Soviet alliance. One of the most important points that Oglesby makes is that as the Galen organization was being incorporated into the U.S. intelligence system, Reinhard Galen was still seeking approval from his military and political superiors, notably Admiral von Dönitz, Karl von Dönitz, who succeeded Adolf Hitler, and also General Franz Halder, H-A-L-D-E-R, who was his immediate Wehrmacht superior. I also noted that the Galen organization worked very, very closely with the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the main organization of the SS, and in particular it was very close, that the Galen organization was very close to the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS Intelligence Service, and Amt 6, the foreign affairs branch of the Sicherheitsdienst, headed up by Walter Schellenberg. Now, Carl Oglesby advances the hypothesis, and this is something I have also spoken of, that the Galen organization literally served as a Trojan horse in the United States. Although being brought, it was brought into the country ostensibly to serve the United States, in fact, it turned out to be an extremely destructive thing for the United States. We're going to be taking a look at just how destructive it was. And again, I think the Trojan horse metaphor that was advanced by Carl Oglesby in Covert Action Information Bulletin number 33 is a very, very accurate one. Recall that one of the points that Oglesby cites is that part of the agreement that was reached between Reinhard Galen and his ostensible masters in the United States was that when there was a conflict between German interests and American interests, as far as the Galen organization went, that the Galen organization could be understood, would be understood to act on behalf of German interests, and that's exactly what it did. What we're going to be looking at this evening is how the Galen organization functioned as a Trojan horse, and how the Galen organization began to function as a vehicle for literally defeating the United States. Not defeating it on the battlefield, not defeating it militarily, but defeating it economically and politically by affecting the American military strategic perceptions, and also, and in connection with that, affecting American political life as well. What we're going to be taking a look at this evening is just how the Galen organization affected American strategic perceptions, and in connection with that, how American strategic perceptions and the Galen organization affected American political life. What we're going to begin looking at this evening is another work, or a short section, of another work by Carl Oglesby. We're going to be reading now a short section from a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War, subtitled Conspiracies from Dallas to Watergate and Beyond. That is authored by Carl Oglesby, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y. It was published in softcover by Berkeley Medallion Books and was copyrighted 1976. Of the effect of the Galen organization on the United States, Carl Oglesby writes as follows in The Yankee and Cowboy War. Look what power the victors conceded the vanquished. Exclusive purveyor of intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to the United States, West Germany, and NATO, Galen and the spirit kept alive in him and his staff had more power over official American perceptions in the post-war world than even a German victory could have given them. The Galen-Vlasov intelligence system had become a main source and fountain of official American consciousness. Indeed, Oglesby's statement is very, very accurate. What we're going to look at this evening is how the Galen organization affected the American political consciousness. And I would note, too, that I think Oglesby's statement is very accurate, that the spirit kept alive in Galen and his staff had more power over official American perceptions than even a Nazi victory could have given them. Even, suppose for the sake of argument, that the Third Reich had conquered the United States militarily during the Second World War, and we were an occupied country, the official pronouncements of the German occupation government would have been greeted by the vast majority of Americans with extreme skepticism. They would have said basically, oh, well, that's just the Gestapo talking, that's Herr Goebbels talking, we can't believe a word of that. But when the perceptions of the Galen organization, both military and political, as we will see this evening, were presented under the rubric of the old red, white, and blue, they gained a credibility in the eyes of the American military planners and in the eyes of American politicians, and most importantly, in the eyes of the American public, that they could never have had the Third Reich conquered the United States militarily. Again, the American people would have greeted the pronouncements of a German occupation government with a great deal of skepticism. However, when the same pronouncements and the same perceptions were presented to the American people and their political and military leaders under the auspices of the red, white, and blue, they gained a credibility and an influence and a power that they could never have had otherwise. And what we're going to look at this evening is how that influence by the Galen organization was wielded. We will come back to the assassination of President Kennedy in weeks to come and take a look at the ultimate culmination of the generation of political consciousness in the United States by the Galen organization that resulted in November of 63 in the assassination of John Kennedy, and ultimately the liberation or rollback theory, the Galen genesis of which we will be looking at this evening, had its culmination in the Reagan and Bush years, and we will be taking a look at the Reagan and Bush administration as the ultimate fulfillment of rollback or liberation theory vis-a-vis fighting the Cold War. And we will take a look also, we will review very briefly in weeks to come some of the major points of Radio Free America program number 36, the destabilization of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. We're going to begin by taking a look at one of the main ways that the Galen organization influenced American strategic thinking and how it was able to influence the course of the Cold War, and that is by provoking the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union became aware of the negotiations between the alliance, I should say, between the Galen organization and the United States early on. That in and of itself helped to exacerbate tensions between the United States and Soviet Union and helped to preclude what possibility there might have been of a satisfactory diplomatic and political resolution to the conflicts and the disagreements between the USSR and the United States. Now, as Oglesby has pointed out, this is not to say in any way that there would not have been a Cold War without the Galen organization. There almost certainly would have been, but the degree of tension between the U.S. and the former USSR and the effects of the Cold War on American political life and on the world political structure would have been vastly different had the Galen organization not been brought into the United States, where, again, it served as a wing of the Odessa and it served as a Trojan horse inside of the United States. In addition to examining how the Galen organization helped to exacerbate tensions between the U.S. and USSR by provoking the Soviet Union, we're going to take a look at the grossly exaggerated reports that were given by the Galen organization to the U.S. National Security Establishment concerning not only Soviet intentions, but Soviet military capabilities as well. Basically, the Galen organization fed the United States a lot of very serious BS about both what the Soviets were up to and what they were capable of doing militarily, and this did much to fan the flames of the Cold War, to mix a metaphor. It did a great deal to exacerbate tensions between the U.S. and the USSR, which ultimately led to the very destructive arms race which bankrupted the Soviet Union and led to its dissolution in considerable measure. It also in considerable measure led to the bankrupting of the United States, and it's one of the main reasons why we are in the current situation that we are in. After taking a look at the Galen organization and how it provoked the Soviet Union and how it misled the United States about Soviet capabilities and intentions, we're going to take a look at how the Galen organization and related Third Reich elements were able to fundamentally alter American political thinking in the Cold War period, in the McCarthy period in particular. We're going to take a look at how U.S. intelligence, the CIA in particular, introduced many of the Soviet and Eastern European fascist emigre, who comprised a very important element of the Galen organization, how they were introduced into the United States during the Cold War period as a result of illegal operations inside of the United States by elements of the CIA, in particular the CFF, the Crusade for Freedom, and how these Galen and Galen-related elements were to lead to the generation of liberation or rollback theory of fighting the Cold War. Originally, liberation theory began as a Third Reich political and psychological warfare tactic and as a major pillar of Third Reich covert operations. We're going to see how that evolved not only into a major pillar of American and CIA political warfare, but how it became a major force in American political thinking, ultimately having a profound effect on the development of the Republican Party, among other American political interests. And we are also, later on, we will touch back on something that we've already touched on, namely how many of the tactics that were inherent in the liberation or rollback theory as practiced by the Third Reich eventually came to be used by the U.S. national security establishment, by our intelligence services, and one tactic in particular espoused by the NTS or Solidarists, the tactic of provoking a mutiny by the Red Army, ultimately saw its fulfillment in the August 1991 coup, which was unsuccessful and which provoked a mutiny by the Red Army, which led to not only the outlawing of the Soviet Communist Party, but which led to the dissolution, the physical dissolution of the Soviet Union itself. But the main focus this evening will be on how the Galen Organization affected American strategic and political thinking. For the duration of the broadcast this evening, we're going to take a look at the single most important book about not only the Galen Organization, but about the importation of residual Third Reich elements into the U.S. national security establishment. That book is entitled Blowback, subtitled America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Effects on the Cold War, and that was authored by Christopher Simpson, S-I-M-P-S-O-N. It was published in hardcover by Weidenfeld and Nicholson and copyrighted 1988. Weidenfeld, by the way, is W-E-I-D-E-N-F-E-L-D, and they're located in New York. What we're going to begin looking at is the interaction between the Office of Strategic Services, World War II's intelligence, American Intelligence Service, or the American Intelligence Service in World War II, and the Galen Organization. In Carl Oglesby's essay, which I read last week, he does not discuss the contacts between the OSS and the Galen Organization. They were eclipsed or ignored in Oglesby's work, but it is important to understand that the OSS and many of the key officials in the OSS who went on to become major players in the CIA were in fact deeply involved with the generation of the Galen Organization and its incorporation into the United States. Simpson writes of this in Blowback as follows. General William Wild Bill Donovan and Alan Dulles of America's Wartime Clandestine Operations Agency, the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, were also tipped off about Galen's offer by a Dulles double agent inside the German Foreign Office. The OSS was soon jockeying with U.S. military intelligence for institutional authority over Galen's microfilmed records, and before long, over control of the German spymaster himself. And in a footnote to that passage, he goes on to add, Frank Wisner's Special Intelligence Branch staff, which was engaged in work with Galen, had more than its share of brilliant operatives who were to leave their marks on the history of U.S. espionage. They included Richard Helms, for example, later to become CIA Deputy Director for Clandestine Operations, and eventually Agency Director under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. William Casey, CIA Director under President Reagan, Harry Rositzky, R-O-S-I-T-Z-K-E, soon to become Chief of CIA Clandestine Operations inside the USSR, and later CIA Chief of Station in India, and of course Wisner himself, soon to be Chief of all American Clandestine Warfare Operations worldwide. Of course, it was Wisner who brought in, among others, Stefan Bandera and his OUNB organizations, the connections between that organization, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and, among other things, the assassination of John Kennedy is something that we looked at in the second installment of this particular archive show. And again, I go into the Wisner's Special Intelligence Branch of the OSS and its connections to Galen, because again, William Casey, a major player in the resolution of the historical conflicts that we're looking at in Radio Free America 37, William Casey was a major player under the Reagan administration. Now, of the manner in which the incorporation of the Galen Organization helped to exacerbate the tensions already existing between the Soviet Union and the United States, Simpson writes as follows. The documentation that might establish exactly how much President Truman knew about American recruitment of Galen and his organization remains classified. It is known, however, that the Soviets made vigorous protests against this secret agreement at least as early as the Potsdam Conference, thus it is unlikely that the matter escaped Truman's attention altogether. Considering the senior status of Donovan, Dulles, Siebert, and the other U.S. intelligence officers known to have been directly involved, and considering that two competing American intelligence bureaucracies were attempting to share Galen's archives, it is reasonable to suspect that the president had been well briefed about this operation. Now, more in blowback about the effects of the Galen organization in exacerbating U.S.-USSR tensions, and it should be noted that as early as the Potsdam Conference, the Soviet Union was already protesting to the United States about the Galen organization. More from Christopher Simpson's blowback. Contrary to the accepted wisdom, however, U.S. dependence on Galen's organization for intelligence on the Soviet military was quite likely a blunder from a strictly practical point of view. For one thing, enlisting Galen was in itself a substantial escalation of the Cold War that undermined what little hope was possible for East-West cooperation during the pivotal years of 1945 to 1948. And again, I will reiterate what Oglesby said in the essay and Covert Action Information Bulletin. This should not be interpreted as meaning that the United States, that there would not have been a Cold War had the U.S. not incorporated Galen. There would have been, but the effect of the Galen organization on the degree of alienation between the USSR and the United States, and ultimately the effects of the Galen organization on the history of the world in the second half of the 20th century, well, those effects were dramatic, and the Cold War would have had a very, very different effect on world history had it not been for the Galen organization. Now, what we're going to look at next, aside from the role of the Galen organization in provoking the Soviets, and obviously they were aware as early as the 1945 Potsdam Conference about the Galen-U.S. agreement, one of the most important ways that the Galen organization affected the development of American political life was by feeding grossly exaggerated, grossly inaccurate intelligence to the United States about just what the Galen organization was, or what the Soviet Union, I should say, was up to, what it was planning to do politically, and what it was capable of doing both politically and militarily. Simpson writes about this in a chapter appropriately entitled The Eyes and Ears. Of all the networks of former Nazis and collaborators employed by the United States after World War II, it is Galen's organization that has left the most substantial imprint on the United States. Galen's analysis of the forces that guide Soviet behavior, which were forged in part by his personal defeat at the hands of the Russians during World War II, became widely accepted in U.S. intelligence circles and remains so to this day. Galen's singular error, says Arthur Macy Cox, COX, a career Soviet affairs analyst who has served with both the CIA and the Department of State, is that he presented the political threat posed by the USSR as though it were an imminent military problem, thus, quote, ingratiating himself, unquote, as Cox puts it, again quoting, with the unreconstructed Cold Warriors in the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill. Galen's influential intelligence and analysis also strongly reinforced the, quote, communist conspiracy, unquote, model of foreign affairs, in which the hand of the Kremlin could be seen in almost every labor dispute and student strike on the continent. Now, one of the points that I want to underscore very heavily this evening is that the Galen organization's effect on the United States should in no way be seen outside of the context of other major American factors in American politics and American society, which provided the vehicle for the Galen organization to influence American society in the way that it did. The Galen organization and the analysis that I'm presenting this evening should never be seen as existing in a political vacuum. Rather, and this is one of the most important points in this installment of Radio Free America 37, rather, the profound effect of the Galen organization on the United States and the effect the Galen organization has had on world history could only have been accomplished as a result of its interaction with very powerful elements in the American political makeup, namely some of the elements cited here, the, quote, unreconstructed Cold Warriors, unquote, in the Pentagon and in Capitol Hill, the defense industry in particular, what President Eisenhower referred to as the military-industrial complex, was a major element which permitted the Galen Organization to have the effect that it had. And obviously the industrialists and financiers in this country, both those of conservative bent who were afraid of communism and also those of explicitly fascist orientation, the ones that we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and other broadcasts, they were already very receptive not only to the exaggerated picture of the Soviet Union that Galen presented, but also to the explicitly fascist nature of the Galen Organization, and ultimately that fascist nature came to be expressed directly in American political life, as we will see. What we're going to look at now is how the Galen Organization provided grossly inaccurate intelligence to the United States. Now, a word briefly about the Soviet occupation of much of Eastern Europe. One of the factors that is largely ignored or overlooked by American political analysts is the fact that in addition to Japan, Germany, and Italy, the main Axis nations of World War II, the Axis was also comprised of Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria, three of the nations occupied by the Soviet Union, which became the Warsaw Pact nations. Another major element of the Warsaw Pact, obviously, was East Germany, which, of course, was part of the original German Reich. It should also be noted that Czechoslovakia, under Nazi occupation, was divided up, and Slovakia became an independent fascist state under the Third Reich, and now it has achieved its independence again in the post-Cold War period. We'll discuss that fleetingly during the course of the program, during the course of Radio Free America 37 in later installments. It should be noted that from the Soviet point of view, much of what they were doing in Eastern Europe was occupying and altering the political structure of fascist nations, nations which had participated in the enormously destructive invasion of the Soviet Union. Again, Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, East Germany, and Slovakia, part of Czechoslovakia, were all part of the Axis in World War II. It should also be noted that Poland, although it was not part of the Axis, was a fascist country prior to World War II. Poland for many years was dominated by the brutal dictator Pilsudski, and Pilsudski, although a strong Polish nationalist, was basically a fascist and described as such by, among others, George Seldes, regarded by many as the dean of American investigative reporters. Because, however, Poland was nationalistic and because it lay between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, it ultimately became the first victim of Nazi conquest and suffered brutally under the occupation of the Third Reich. One of the things that we looked at in Radio Free America program number 14 and that we reprised to a considerable extent in Radio Free America program number 36 was the Promethean League, or the Prometheus Organization. That was sort of a pre-Wackle Wackle. It was an anti-communist coalition which was based in Poland and which operated to a large extent as a result of Polish support. It was also financed heavily by France. But the Promethean League, an explicitly anti-Soviet organization, not only functioned in Poland under Pilsudski and then Pilsudski's successor, whose name I've forgotten, but he was basically a Pilsudski puppet, but later the Promethean League was incorporated into the Third Reich after its successful invasion of Poland and worked against the Soviet Union during World War II. We're going to look at now, again, a discussion of how the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe and the Soviet intentions and military capabilities were fundamentally exaggerated by Galen, and how this exaggeration came to affect the American strategic thinking and ultimately American political life as well.